Hey, now, if you owe the IRS over $20,000 in back taxes, or you're under an audit, or if you have unfiled tax returns, this is actually a really serious problem. The IRS is the most brutal collection agency on the planet. You don't want to go up against these guys on your own. You need the experts at Tax Resolution Services. I met with these guys, and they say the time to act is now. Not when you get a job and you start to get back up on your feet. When you're on your butt, that's when they can help you the most. They will deal with the IRS on your behalf. Tax Resolution has been saving people's financial lives for 15 years. And all that comes with it, no more sleepless nights, threatening letters from the IRS, wage garnishments, frozen bank accounts, all that ends. Do not live in fear anymore. Now is the time to act. The problems are not going to go away on their own. You need to deal with these things now because, as with everything that you deny and put off, they get worse. Call Tax Resolution Services at 888-457-2049. Got me? It's 888-457-2049. These are great guys, and they will help you. Or you can log on to taxresolution.com.
This is Corolla Digital.
Welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast, and I am really excited today. It's a big, big treat for me. I have Chris Kennedy, law firm. He has written a book called Recover to Live, Kick Any Habit, Manage Any Addiction, available now on Amazon. Go ahead and click through the banner at the drdrew.com website. Now, Chris, you went out and interviewed, I think, hundreds, if not 100.
Yeah, 150.
150 probably. Of sort of the experts in addiction and recovery.
Right.
This is it. This is the last word that this country has to offer on addiction. And Chris has been going around and talking about it. First of all, I want to tell you about what – have you learned anything since the book? How has it been received? Are people – when you go around – I know you've been all over the place talking about the book.
Right. I've been all over the – and it's been good. I mean, I think – you know, my hope was the recovery community would really step up and that this would be a big deal in terms of that. That hasn't happened quite as much as I would have hoped. I think the professional community – I've gotten a lot of reviews from folks, psychologists, those kinds of things, because it's a real – this is a first of its kind, obviously, and yeah. I did interview you for the book.
It's a complicated issue, and I think That's why professionals would appreciate it because Recovery tends to look at things in pretty black and white terms. And
that's right.
It gets – when you look at the complexities, that you start to go, ugh.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why nobody really wants to deal with it
because
it is too complicated.
Yeah, right.
And so this book, I think, simplifies things. It gets people some really good information. I would say the best information available on the planet today about these what I call the seven toxic compulsions. And because, as we know, this is a brain illness. And you know, my experience in recovery in 27 years in dealing with this has been if somebody doesn't present with more than one of these – initially, they develop more than one of them in recovery.
Well, that happens a lot.
That happens a lot.
So tell what are the seven?
So alcohol, drugs, sex, hoarding, gambling, nicotine, tobacco, and food.
Now, it's did you come to those? Because that's really interesting to me.
Right. Well, we just took now I've got a section on shopping and workaholism and all of that. We deal with some of the other
stuff,
ones.
Gambling
that are
and things, yeah.
Well, gambling's a major one.
Yeah.
And obviously the DSM, I mean, hoarding was not – now it is. And, so I tried to get to the ones that were the most – compelling, I guess, in terms of numbers, really.
But it is interesting that very often, and what you caught my ear is that you said it happens in recovery, is that the life-threatening component goes down, but suddenly people leave a little room for the gambling,
absolutely.
Or the sex,
or
the hoarding happens magically.
Absolutely. And this is the interesting thing. Look, I've been in recovery for 27 years. I go to hot yoga every single day. So it turns – I just built a house in L.A. and the guy – he made me a jacuzzi and a cold plunge. So I can take a hot jacuzzi and then jump in freezing cold water because it shuts my brain off. Mm. Now, this is after 27 years. Now, I meditate. I do all the things that we need to do.
You still have that brain.
But I still have the brain.
Yeah, you still have to get high. That's right. That's, this and that.
That's exactly right. So, and, you know, exercises, obviously, think a lot of these things are a little bit more benign.
Yeah.
But they still, there is still a compulsivity that goes on and a need that people have and an avoidance of things. I've looked at my own behavior and I've thought, what is so uncomfortable in my existence that I have to run to this thing? I've got to go to class today. I've got to go to this.
I think I told you about my little theory about the evolution of that brain, didn't I?
Tell me again.
Well, it's that what you're describing is a brain that needs to be doing and focused.
Right.
And that brain really gets high in extreme circumstances. Mm-hmm. So if a nuclear bomb went off right now, you would be activated. You would be into taking action and moving and solving right. and whatever. You wouldn't even think about anything for a few days, and you would
right.
love every second of it.
That's right.
A non-alcoholic would be like, holy shit, this is miserable. I'm going to die. I don't know what to
right.
do. I'm paralyzed.
Right.
It's why addicts make great shortstops and extreme athletes
right.
and fighter pilots. And I'm firmly of the belief that this brain evolved. It's a more evolved form of the human brain mm-hmm. in extreme adversity. Because
yeah.
in extreme adversity, this is the kind of brain you want to have.
Yeah, that's
if,
right.
If there was, if you're in Scotland in 1066 and a bunch of British come over the hill,
right.
you want to be the alcoholic brain because you're
right.
going to survive better than right. the ones that are running the other way, getting the spears in their back.
Right.
You guys are all in
right,
focused.
Right,
you,
right.
Things look great. Anxiety goes away,
right.
strangely,
right.
in those
that's,
situations.
That's right.
For the normal person, anxiety peaks
right.
in those situations.
And it comes back
later
when there's no.
That's when you're in the cold
yeah,
plunge.
That's
when you have
right.
to jump in the
yeah.
cold water.
That's right.
And it's a liability in times of peace, but it's quite an asset in extreme, particularly
right.
military kind of extreme situations.
Right. And it makes it difficult for folks to really, even in recovery, to really enjoy their lives.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the quandary.
Yeah. And I believe, correct me if you've learned this through the exploration, the solution, a lot of it, is interpersonal.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's quiet and sitting, and that's hard to do if you're
right.
an addict.
Well, it's interesting because I've noticed this. And Alan Shore, who's one of the guys I interviewed, he's a neuroscientist at UCLA.
Did I refer you to him?
No, you didn't. But
he's one of my heroes.
Amazing guy. And he talked to me about the research he was doing on the relational part of the brain, which he said is fully developed by the time you speak or by the time
six
you're
months.
3 years old.
Right, 6 months when it really kicks in.
Okay. So you, and this idea that if you don't bond with somebody in that time, you'll have relational trauma for the rest of your life that you will try to medicate. And we know from the literature of 12-step literature that they say somewhere in the 12 and 12 that the root cause of our alcoholism is our defective relations with others. This is obviously the key here for folks. And I live in Hawaii, and I was with my girl, and her mom came to visit. And she is from a family that hangs out. Like, she expected me to be around, like, sitting on the porch, and I don't do that.
Can't do
that. I can't do it.
It's uncomfortable.
It's really uncomfortable,
yeah.
even after 27 years.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in my mother never stayed at my house in my life.
Yeah.
She would come stay in a hotel, we'd have dinner, and it was all, you know, so... This is and what we get back to is the complexity of this brain illness.
Well, see, I've thought a lot about this. Right. Alan actually asked me to speak at his
attachment conference
about this issue,
great.
how to form an attachment with an alcoholic addict, right. which is really what I've always thought my job was to be the first
right.
model of connection for an alcoholic so they can then translate that back to their recovering peers and their sponsor and stuff.
That's
great. The basic model I've always – and I learned it through studying – I study Alan Shore's – if anybody's interested, he's written – let's put Alan Shore's like the hell's the one called? The affect regulation and the origin of the self. That's his Bible.
Right.
And I've studied that thing like scripture.
I mean, it's
like
amazing
my books.
Yeah.
Yeah. And basically it's your right brain communication, nonverbal, nonconscious,
right.
two bodies relating to one another. And I think actually addiction is two hits. I think it's the genetic component we were
right.
talking about, which is that brain that's got to do and
mm-hmm.
needs to get high, and the attachment.
Yeah.
And then you throw in personal, like childhood trauma,
trauma.
Now it's game on. That's rocket fuel now. And so you can't repair the trauma because trauma repair is an intersubjective experience. If intersubjectivity, being close to another person, is so threatening. because that's where you experience the trauma, that you can't enter the frame to be vulnerable again.
What do you
You're
do?
Fucked. You're going to get high.
Right.
And that works for an addict brain. That works until it doesn't work, until you cause the disease.
But I mean, think about this conversation that we're having now. Because when I began my stuff, we didn't know any of this.
Well, what's fascinating to me is we didn't know any of this. But the big book talked
about
it.
You knew it's crazy. 75 years
intuitively, people knew there was something like this going on. And we're just working out the biology, the specifics now. We're getting all the wiring down. I mean, I guess the ultimate goal would be is if we could like inject a little genetic something that'll help the wiring and make you capable of entering the frame with other people and not have to respond to that motivational nonsense. I don't have much hope for that.
I think.
And by the way, would you not agree with me that if we – let's say we had that. Let's say we had some magic pill that would rewire and decrease the motivational drive and the hoarding and everything goes away and then it increases your ability to regulate your emotions and be present with other people. There'd still be something missing.
There'd still – yeah. And I mean
– That's the part the medical community doesn't get.
Right. And I talked to Nora Volko about this because she's –
Did she get it?
You know, she's put all her eggs in the vaccine basket.
Yeah.
And I said, Nora,
no way.
Look, if you have a cocaine vaccine, whoever you vaccinate is going to find something else, some other – she goes, well, vaccinate for all of them.
She's never treated a drug addict in her life. She doesn't deal with drug addicts.
Right, I know.
She doesn't know.
Right. She's a very smart woman.
Oh, she's wonderful. We need her research.
I know.
I love her. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But the reason she reaches bizarre conclusions is she's never dealt with drugs.
That's right.
The other group that's dangerous are the ones that treat drug addicts but believe everything they tell them.
Right.
It's funny you say that because
I remember having this conversation with Nora, and I love Nora, and she would say, I would say, you know, I'm crazy. She goes, you can't say that. I go, Nora, I'm crazy. And it's okay. And then I would say, you know, so someday I might go, I always had this thing, well, like one day when I'm done with all of this, I'm just going to go to an island somewhere and drink myself to death or whatever. Because, I mean, but I don't do it today. And she would go, you can't have that ideation because you'll act. No, I know. But this is the difference in somebody like you who understands this, not only the science and the behavior and the people. It's complicated.
Few
people get it.
But that part where you said and the people part,
right?
That's the part you're talking about here, which is also this holistic, spiritual. Almost, I've started studying philosophy because of doing drug addicts, because you get philosophical at a certain point, that you harbor that fantasy, I think, is A, hysterical, and B, I totally get it.
That's right,
and C. So long as you're spiritually connected to something, probably won't happen.
Right.
Explain that with an fMRI. You know what I mean? You can't.
Right.
You can't do it.
No, you
can't. It's a different realm.
No, I know.
And so that's why when I say even if we could wire you all upright again, there'd still be that thing.
There'd be a missing – and it is spiritual, and as you point out. And what's unfortunate to me in terms of – and the whole Suboxone thing and what's happening in terms of the medicalization of this whole deal, which is problematic. And where are the voices? I know.
I'm getting crushed for standing up.
I understand that. And you shouldn't be alone. There's a community out here in the world of recovering people that are anonymous and invisible. And we need them.
I know. They need to speak up.
Yeah.
And I understand the medicalization, too, because there's some people who are going to die if they don't do something.
No, absolutely.
And it might be too dangerous to do something for some people, or it might be a temporizing maneuver. I get it. It's fine. But if it's the complexities of it aren't evaluated for a given case. Mm-hmm. And the thing about replacement I've always said, and I say it over and over again, which is, okay, fine, I get that it's okay. But isn't it funny that when a doctor develops drug addiction, we never put them on replacement?
I know.
Ever?
Or airline pilots.
Or attorneys. Because you can't return to your profession if you're loaded on opiates.
Right.
And even when you're on Suboxone, which diminishes some of the symptoms of the disease for a while, still lie, still bullshit, still obfuscate, still spiritual bankrupt.
Right.
Still the seven habits seem to come along with it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hmm.
Yeah.
But then they'll point at us and go, you don't do much better with 12-step.
Right. Well, we don't really know because we can't really – The numbers aren't there on a variety of. They're pretty good from where I sit.
Me too. I agree with you. I know lots of people whose lives are richer than ever.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, don't they count for something?
I guess not.
What else would people want to know that you learned in the process of writing the book?
Well, I mean, I think the interconnectivity of all of these things is one of them. I think the prevalence of this illness in terms of and when you take it all into consideration, there's 200 million people who are directly affected by this illness in the United States of America. That's 2/3 of our population. And the amount of resources that are dedicated to doing something about it, given its cost, is ridiculous.
Ridiculous, yeah.
And so, three times what cancer costs. I just on and on and on and on. I learned an awful lot. And, there were things that were amazing to me. Walking into Robert DuPont's office and who was NIDA and, first drug czar NIDA and under Nixon became this because he put half of Washington, the addict population, on methadone and cut the crime rate in half.
Right.
And walked in there and he goes, "You want to solve the problem of addiction in this country?" I went, "Yeah." He goes, "Send everybody to 12-step programs."
This is the guy that...
Oh, yeah. No, Robert DuPont, and who's a brilliant guy and has dedicated his whole life, Harvard, to this illness. And he has come full circle and told me amazing stories. The people I got to interview, all these books is always at that. It's the connection that I get from the folks that are doing, whether it was Moments of Clarity and getting people's, epiphanies to people who are working in the field who really do amazing work. It's phenomenal to be able to do these kind of
books. It's inspiring to hear that he comes around because those methadone guys are very...
Oh, yeah.
Let's talk about Moments of Clarity. Did you learn anything about what those are or what leads to them or where they come from?
It's interesting. I spoke at a conference on Cape Cod. It was a science conference, basically, but it was also, sort of organized by C4, and they'd, they're 12-step.
What's C4?
Well, it's a group of they're oriented in treatment, and they definitely have a healthy respect for 12-step programs, but they believe in sort of,
other things. Let me just say before you answer that question, the other things also component comes in people that are what some people have coined the term almost addicts.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a population that have the disease in its earlier stages, haven't lost control, haven't fully triggered the biology yet.
Non-dependent use disorders. Or
I would even knock it down from there. Yeah,
okay.
More like just before non-dependent use disorders, because that can be a pretty bad group.
That's right.
But that may respond to other things like CBT and individual therapy, and don't necessarily need 12-step. It can look pretty good over a long period of time.
Right.
That's a group that also pretty silent out there.
And absolutely.
People don't identify them as a separate group and don't understand that they have separate needs and things.
And one of the things that blew me away when I talked to Tom McClellan about the actual numbers of people who have a chemical dependency, if you look at the federal numbers, it's 22, 24 million people with a chemical dependency. There are three times as many people who have a non-dependent use disorder. There's 60 million people who have a non-dependent. To me, that was like there's 80 million people walking around with a chemical dependency issue.
Yeah.
That's influencing their lives in pretty negative ways.
And by the way, there's probably another 80 million of just random use disorders.
Right.
Like almost use disorders.
Right. So are we a culture of addicts, this kind of thing? But
so at this conference.
So this conference, I went in there and I told basically my story, which is a story of an epiphany. I knew I was an addict when I went to Georgetown University and just to become an American Studies major to emulate my Uncle Jack, President Kennedy, and, learn history, write a book, win a Pulitzer Prize, become a war hero, and then become President of the United States.
Okay, so hold on. So wait, I didn't know this about you. So is Jack gone by that point, or are you still?
Oh, no. He was... dead.
And, so John Kennedy is gone.
Yeah.
And you're going to Georgetown.
I'm going to Georgetown. And basically,
but he's your hero.
He's my hero.
And you want to be him.
Yeah, I want to be him. And so the path to that was, write a book in college, win a Pulitzer Prize like he did. He wrote While England Slept about World War II. become a war hero, have a major health problem to overcome. He almost died many times from his various issues, his medical issues, and then become president of the United States at 43 years old. Well, I moved in next door to a commune of heroin addicts at Georgetown until I was goodbye to Jefferson and Fitzgerald and hello to cops and doctors. And I got 1 out of 5, a major health problem to overcome, basically. And so after, and I knew at that moment, because nothing like knowing you have a problem becoming addicted to heroin, that will tell you immediately that you have a problem.
Yeah.
And for the next 10 years, tried everything in my power to do something about that issue. Okay. And then at 30, finally, I had been to 12-step programs 2 years before and nothing had worked. Okay, so at 30, I woke up one day and I'm like, I've tried everything. I tried doctors. I tried experimental drugs. I tried LAM. I tried naltrexone before it was approved. I tried therapists at Harvard. I tried McLean's Hospital. Man, I tried everything.
LAM has been around for a long time.
Yeah.
That was going to solve everything. That was another one of those.
That's right.
Norvolca would have loved that.
Yeah,
day.
Absolutely. So, but the point is I tried everything and nothing worked. And so I was going to kill myself. And I had a moment. I didn't know I'd had that moment, but addicts always have plan B. My plan B was to call the one guy I didn't want to call and ask him what to do. He was a cousin. He was sober. We had competed my whole life. I never wanted to go to him. I went to him, and if he had said, crawl on your belly over broken glass to New York, I would have done it. He said, go back to 12-step programs. I didn't say, I've been there. It didn't work.
How did you... That's such an interesting impulse to have, to call the guy that had
the
answer,
guy,
but you didn't. The guy you really didn't want to call.
Didn't want to call.
Most addicts will get the softer, kinder something in there.
Yeah, no, but I think we all get these little windows of opportunities. I mean, humans get them. We get them and we either go through them or we don't.
Yeah.
And this was one of those windows. Yeah. And I went through it and I went back to 12-step programs and I did whatever they told me to do and it became my life and my life changed. Mm. And I had a gradual spiritual awakening. Now, I had another thing when I was in New York. I was sober about 30 days.
When you called your cousin, were you strung out on heroin then?
No, what I was doing was I had gone to 12-step programs and I figured they were going to teach me how to use, like it says in the big book. They go, I'll use heroin for a couple of days,
but
when I don't get a physical habit, because I thought it was all physical.
Yeah, yeah.
So as long as I wasn't addicted, I was okay.
You're right.
Okay, ridiculous, right?
So
I go to New York. I'm going to meetings every minute of every day. I've got people around me who are sober, and I still have the craving. So I'm looking at these bar signs and these pharmacies are blinking at me going, come back, come back. The guy goes, he comes. I said, what am I going to do?
Who's the guy?
Well, the guy who was a mentor of mine in recovery. And he goes, go home to your mother. I was staying at my mother's. I was trying to be an actor to get my acting career going. He goes, throw your shoes under the bed. And I said, what are you talking about? He goes, throw your shoes under the bed so you get on your knees and ask a God of your own understanding. I don't care what it is. It could be the light bulb to keep you sober that day and you stay sober. And I was willing to do it. I went back to my mother's house. I closed the curtains. I was so humiliated. Now, listen, I had been arrested. I had been a surrogate for my Uncle Teddy on his presidential campaign. I was arrested my first year of law school. It was on the news, in the newspapers, on the evening news. I had been humiliated. This was the most humiliating thing I'd ever done, getting on my knees.
By yourself?
By myself, in an apartment in New York. I did it because I was that willing. Mm. And within 30 days, that obsession that had vanquished me for 17 years. And listen, I'm very willful, like many of us. I had all the resources, all of the desire to get better, and vanquished me. I couldn't stay sober for a day. I would use all the drugs in the night, and I'd say, I'm not doing that tomorrow, every day. And I would do it. And within 30 days, that obsession vanished.
With prayer and asking for it.
I told this story at this conference, and a guy comes up to me after the conference. He goes, hey, that was really great. He goes, but... you know that thing you were talking about, the spiritual thing, the thing that happened? He goes, that's really interesting to us because we actually think that is something in your brain that switches over. And I said, that's great.
Yeah.
I hope you find it.
Yeah.
But like some guy said to me, you could prove to me that God doesn't exist and I'll still believe because it works for me.
Right.
That's the truth.
And that's what I tell everybody that has an issue with the spiritual component of recovery. It's like, I'm not religious. I don't care what it is talking about. We're talking about something that people respond to. I'll switch it around and say, just call it faith.
Right.
Just call it a faith that the world will go on, a faith that's something bigger than myself, a faith of something. Believe. I don't care what it is. Just believe something. And that's all you need.
Right.
And for addicts, that's hard.
Really hard.
Because it's you're so busy believing about what you want or who you are, right. or your own shit, that
right.
believing something bigger or more important is out there is a hard belief to cling to.
I think Jung said something about touching the hand of God. My friend Richard Dreyfuss, it's about this idea that that's what we're doing when we're taking drugs. We want something more. We want a greater connection to something, and it gives us drugs. Listen, drugs and alcohol worked for a while.
Do you still, my recovering friends and peers will say that they've still never found anything they loved as much as drugs and alcohol. Does that still ring true for you, or have you moved
past that? I did, this is really interesting. I did a workshop. It was called Sage and Warrior. It was like one of these S things. I mean, I went out into the woods for 4 days and they broke me in a very gentle way, but they broke me and they profoundly broke me. And if you think of life as like a big T1 line that goes through your head, everything is filtered through my mind. Mm-hmm. And this switched the T1 from my head to my heart for about 3 weeks. Now, that's the best I can do to explain it, but it was the most profound. It was what I imagine that the mystics talk about when they say this bliss, that living in bliss, that is actually possible without the use of chemicals. I don't know how you get there other than to have sort of a profound breaking of your, of whatever that is, your psyche or your emotional thing. It lasted 3 weeks. It got further and further away, but it was profound.
Was it an openness kind of thing?
It was, all I can tell you, clarity? Is a different way of experiencing life.
Huh.
From your head to your heart, because everything goes, even if I get the great God consciousness or whatever I get, or the feeling that you get from connecting to another human being, those things that really make you feel rooted and wonderful as a human being, they all come through my head. This was a different way of experiencing life.
Coming through your heart.
Yeah. And I couldn't do it if my life depended on it.
Right.
Other than it was done to me. It was somehow, something shifted and it was, I don't know.
Did you have any symptoms afterwards that were unpleasant when it started closing up again?
No.
Good.
It just went away.
Right, right. Whatever that was.
Unfortunately, that was unpleasant, but it was
interesting
reality.
All right. We have calls, yes? Okay. We got to take a quick break. There they are. Let's see what that looks like. Get sober, addicted to pills, overcome addiction. Yes. Now, Trexone. All right. Recover to Live, Kick Any Habit, Manage Any Addiction. The author is Chris Kennedy Lawford. He is here with me today. It's available at Amazon. Please click through at the drdrew.com website to get this book. It is the shared wisdom of really, really what's available out there today. What's everything that's known about this condition compiled in one resource.
Yeah, I wanted a big tent. We want to create a big tent here for everybody.
Yeah, and I hope what people take away is what DuPont said, is ultimately it's complicated, but go to 12-step.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
Right.
Bottom
Absolutely.
Line. ChristopherKennedyLawford.com is the website, at Chris Lawford, ChrisLawford. Take a quick break. Be right back with your calls.
Hi, I'm Larry Miller, but in a way, aren't we all? And this week, on This Week with Larry Miller, we talk about St. Patrick's Day. We talk about the poetry and the essays and the great writing, and maybe a little to do with the bars and pubs. But you know what? It's very meaningful after you've done something. Tune us in, and we think you'll agree. We'll see you here.
All right, Chris Kennedy Lawford is here. We're going right on into your calls. It's the Dr. Drew podcast. Let's start with Annie. Annie, what's going on there?
Hi, Dr. Drew. How are you?
We're good.
My question, basically, in a nutshell, I come from a family of addicts and drug users. I am the youngest of 6, 5 brothers. One died of a heroin addiction. Mm. One's in recovery. A couple others, addicts / recreational drug users.
Hold on a second. Wait. There were 6 kids?
6 kids, yeah.
And they're all addicts? Many. They're 100% addicts?
One is not.
Okay.
One is passed from addiction. One's in recovery.
But so 5 of 6 are drug addicts?
I'm not. So I guess 4 of 6.
4 of 6. Okay. All right. And?
And my mother actually is who I'm calling about mostly. She is not openly saying she's a drug addict, but she has a pretty bad addiction to pills.
Before you go on to your personal, let me do 2 seconds on the genetics of addiction.
Yeah.
Whenever people say every sibling is an addict, it's almost always a Cherokee Indian, American Indian.
Wow.
I don't know why Cherokee, maybe that's mostly what I've dealt with over the years, but American Indian biology is profound for addiction. Mm-hmm. When it's very explosive like this, but affecting roughly 50-50, again, 50-50, you know, if you look, Pascal's triangle is not exactly 50-50, it's like four right. and two. You think in terms of Scottish-Irish descent, is that where you guys are?
Irish, French, Massachusetts.
Yeah, yeah. So the Irish-Scottish. That's where you really get the heavy burdens. And then there are other mixes out there as well. But when somebody comes with a history that's striking, there's usually populations that were isolated.
Yeah.
And multi-generational military
Eastern
assaults.
European.
East Europeans where the people moved across the globe repeatedly and wiped people out. Again, isolated. They would never move out of there. But the greatest is Scotland and Ireland. Yeah. They're just isolated populations that were just repeatedly slaughtered. All right. So go ahead, Annie.
So the biggest question is more with my mother these days. She, like I said, is on many, many pills. I don't even know for what at this point.
How old is she?
She is about 68.
Okay. And?
It's pretty bad. I don't expect her to live very much longer. I mean, half the time you speak to her, she's not coherent. It's extremely difficult. It's made me have to create a lot of boundaries in my life, which has taken a lot of therapy to get there, but we have good boundaries now. The thing that's changed is I had a child in December. She really, you know, she calls. No, she doesn't call. She sends a gift on occasion, but really, you know, not involved at all. Recently, you know, she wants to come visit, but she'll say that and then bail last minute. I guess, how do I explain to my daughter, moving forward in a healthy way, this whole situation, you know, as she gets older, to not know why her, you know, her grandmother doesn't care enough to see her, or if she does see her, why she's out of her head? I don't know how you explain this to somebody. I mean, she's only 2 months old. It's going to be a little while before she understands this, but I guess I want to prepare for it.
Well, it's a great question. You're right. She is a little too young now, but I've dealt with this with my own kids. This is a disease, obviously, that runs in families, and the passing on your genetic legacy to knowledge of your genetic legacy to your kids is a really important fundamental thing to do as a parent, I think. And we have such a difficult time with this issue, where we wouldn't have a difficult time necessarily with cancer or anything like that, to as a preventative measure. In terms of the behavioral stuff, you know, the way that she is, I think, you know, I remember growing up and it was always like, well, mom had a difficult life.
Right.
I mean, that was like the
kind of... We had lots of euphemism for those things.
And this...
She had a sugar problem.
Right. Yeah, and I think calling it what it is, I believe in telling the truth.
Yeah, absolutely. Just say she has addiction. It's in our family. And this is how she deals with it. It affects her in ways. She still loves you very much. So she's not a bad person.
Right.
But she's
you
old now.
You would say
now.
That even to a 5-year-old if they asked?
I've said those kinds of things to my own kids,
okay.
Starting from a very young age.
Me too.
It's sort of, Annie, I have to tell you, I'm actually mystified by people's resistance to doing that. It's so matter of fact to me.
Right.
It'd be like saying, grandma has blonde hair and she wears a wig now, but did you ever notice she has blonde hair? She wears a wig because she doesn't like the blonde hair or whatever. It's just matter of fact. It's just grandma. It's part of who she is. We wish, you know, maybe she'd done something with this earlier, but she never got it treated. So now it affects her a little bit.
And it's amazing how well kids do with honesty
and
really good information. It definitely has an effect. I have people that come up to me all the time and they go, well, I'm nervous about telling my kids about my own drug use. Because, you know, might give them permission.
Oh, there's something there, though. I will tell you that is that if you're not an addict,
right,
and you don't want your kids to experiment,
right,
have a zero tolerance, and don't discuss what you did or didn't do till they're adults.
Right.
Don't lie. Do not lie to your kids ever.
Right.
But go, no, we're not discussing it. Here's what I expect of you. That's it, period. And at 25, you want to say, yeah, I smoked a little pot when I was 19, whatever. Fine. Right. Then you do. But it has an entirely different impact, and I've seen this over and over again on kids, than if you say, you know.
Is the impact different if you're an addict?
If you're an addict, you must tell them everything. They must participate in the recovery.
That's right, you got to
go, look, I have an illness. Here's where it took me. Right. If you want to tell the war story, fine.
Right.
But because of that, we have to manage this all the time. You may have to manage it too, and just let me educate you about it.
Right.
So there you go, Annie.
Thank you so much.
All right,
appreciate
sure thing.
It.
Bye, Annie.
Patrick Kennedy, are you close with him at all?
Yeah, very close.
Because
yeah.
he's out of the government now, isn't he?
Yes, he is. No, he's
out. Because I loved it when he was in there. He was the one speaking with
clarity.
Yeah,
he was fantastic.
Him
and Jim Ramstead were the two great leaders.
Got it. And,
totally.
Yeah.
We don't have that anymore. Mary Bonner Mack was trying to kind of do it, and she lost. John Sullivan lost from Oklahoma, who was also in recovery, who was open about it. He got knocked out by the Tea Party. Both of those guys got knocked. I mean, we don't have any political leadership really at this level. Joe Biden has been great on this issue, but as vice president, not available because of the political concerns, and I understand those. I think the Obama administration has been great on policy, and they've done great stuff with demand reduction and the emphasis and the Office on Recovery at the White House and all of this stuff. It's good, but we don't have any leadership. There's nobody out there that's doing what you say, which is talking about this matter of factly.
Yeah, Patrick used to just discuss it.
Yeah.
He would literally, I've shared a podium with a couple times, and he would go, look, I've been in the system.
Yeah, that's
right. Let me tell you,
yeah.
It's not working.
Right.
And here's what you need to do. And he'd just go, hey, this is what I see, and there's a very great clarity. Cannabis, what do you think about the way government's dealing with that? Any opinion or not opinion?
Well, I, you know, personally think, I mean, we know that the two most debilitating drugs to the individual and to society are both legal.
Cigarettes and alcohol.
Yeah. And so do we need another one? And we also know, and I know you've talked about this a lot, is the teenage brain. I mean, you know, in terms of their
well, presumably it will still be illegal for teenagers.
Right, well, it will be illegal, but when you legalize something, the prevalence goes there's no question that there's increased use. I mean, the gambling industry says there isn't with the proliferation of gambling. I don't believe it.
Doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. And So I think it's a major concern. 1 in 6 of kids, the teenagers that smoke marijuana will smoke it chronically, obliterates ambition. Mm. You've got all of the mental illness co-occurring stuff that can happen with kids. I mean, it's too risky. I don't believe in locking people up for use either.
Seems like Kevin Sabet's trying to find a middle ground. You talked to him at all?
Yeah, Kevin's great. And I've worked with Patrick's involved.
Yeah,
and I'm on his board. And I think he's looking for a middle ground. I think that, you know, this has become such a polarized issue, and the train seems to have left the station. George Soros had a huge investment in this in terms of the medicalization of marijuana. And we've really moved down the road where people are going, it's like there's a lot of, you know, energy on the side of legalization, and it's
well, the big concern I have about legalization is that just the way we have big tobacco, we're going to have big pots.
Absolutely,
we're going to have big cannabis out there, and maybe tobacco will be the ones doing it. You know,
it might be
RJR Nabisco.
That's right.
Brings you Purple Kush.
Right.
It could be that.
Yeah.
And then they'll be pushing it on people.
Oh,
they'll
yeah.
be the biggest pushers ever.
I mean, and you go. I've walked into one of those pharmacies. I did it by accident in Venice.
Yeah.
And I was mesmerized. I mean,
stuff.
I was like, it was like, suddenly I was like in a trance. I was like, oh my God. I mean,
you got
I didn't
high
even
just,
like
you,
marijuana.
But you got high just looking at all this
yeah.
stuff. Yeah.
No, and I was thinking, and then everybody goes, well, they've done it so that you don't get paranoid anymore and you can smoke grass to get, you know, to get work done or go to sleep. And they've got all these different kinds of, they've you know, and genetically engineered the pot to be, to do certain things. And I'm thinking, well, that sounds pretty good to me. So it's slippery. It's slippery.
Let's go to more calls. This is Kyle. What's up, Kyle?
Hey, how's it going, Doc? How are you?
I'm good. What's up?
Basically, the question is about alcohol. Been a heavy drinker for the last 10 years, and I kind of used it as a method. I work about 60 hours a week, and I kind of used it as a method of celebratory or awarding myself after a 10 or 12 hour shift. I'm now 3 weeks sober. After going to my doctor, he found a little bit of a liver damage, I guess. My enzymes were out of whack. I mean, he didn't specifically say liver damage, but enzymes were out of whack. He said, take 6 months, then we'll do another blood test. We'll see if, the liver repairs itself. So I'm a little worried about liver damage and how long it takes to repair.
Kyle, I love you. Do you believe that?
What's that?
I love you. You seem like a great guy, but you are so full of shit, it's cracking me up. You have alcoholic liver disease, dude. You drink enough to give yourself alcoholic liver disease. Let's not mince words here. Let's stop with the bullshit. You have serious drinking problem, and you either want to do something about it or you don't. And that's up to you, man. That's entirely up to you. You're going to die of liver disease eventually, and maybe it's worth it to you to keep drinking until you flirt with it, or are you ready to stop now? That's strictly Kyle's call.
Well, I appreciate that and agree. The second part of my kind of thing is I've been sober now 3 weeks. Now, I know that's not a long time, but I did stop 3 weeks ago.
You're white-knuckling for 3 weeks. You're not going to make it too much longer, I suspect.
You going to meetings?
I haven't gone to meetings.
So you're white-knuckling. It's what we call white-knuckling it. Yeah. So you're going to be using again soon. That's okay. That's up to you. Yeah. But if you want to stop, you got to go to some meetings. I'll let Chris talk about that.
Yeah, go to meetings, man. I mean, look, I talk to people. If you want this more than anything you want in your life, which means your sobriety, your chances still aren't very good, in my experience. So if you you can get this. I know millions of people who have. But go to a meeting tomorrow and go to a meeting every day for 90 days and hang on for dear life. And eventually you're going to get better. And you might have a chance at a real life here. Otherwise, you're going to be dead in 5 years.
Maybe not 5 years. You might make it 20.
Yeah.
You might make it 20. You might get to 55 or so.
But it's going to be kind of a diminished existence.
It's going to be – well, that's the interesting piece of this. And Kyle, and Kyle, I hope you don't feel diminished by this conversation because it's just honest, is that it works for him now. And it's not – he doesn't see it as a diminished existence because he doesn't know what the other side has to offer.
Right. That's a great point. And when I got sober, I remember I was 30 days sober, about the time you're sober, and I walked into a recovery meeting and a guy looked at me with these big eyes and this great energy and he said, "You're going to get a life beyond your wildest dreams." And nobody had ever said that to me before. Yeah. And because I thought once – if I gave up – alcohol is your best friend, dude. I get it. I've been there. It even when it stops working, it's your best friend because it's the only thing that got you through. So I'm here to tell you that you will have an amazing life if you can find recovery. And recovery is in church basements. Got to tell you, and it's beyond that. But where you're at right now, you do it alone. This thing will kick your butt.
Think about it. Listen, I feel like we're getting a little preachy with you, and that's not our intention. We want to help, and it's your call, my friend. Okay?
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Good luck, brother.
Good luck, man. You sound like a great guy. As by the way, pretty much all alcoholics are.
Yeah.
There's just a great group of human beings. They'll behave in shitty ways when they're in their disease, but I'm sure you were
sometimes in recovery.
Many times. But still great.
Yeah.
Still crack me up. But I bet you were no fun when you were in your heroin addiction.
No, I wasn't. Yeah. I always wanted, people ask me all the time what I did right. And they said, "What did you do? How'd you do it? And I said, "The only thing I didn't do is I didn't die."
Yeah.
And I always stay connected to wanting to get better. I mean, I had a strong desire. I came from
some
a place where I said no to my friends when I was 12 years old when they tried to get me to take the LSD. Mm. And when my Uncle Bobby was assassinated, my life was obliterated for the second time with brutal public murders. So
how close were you to? Were you close both to Bob and John?
Well, I was 8 when my Uncle Jack died.
Yeah.
When President Kennedy died. Yeah. So I knew him. He used to come to our house. I lived on the beach in California. He'd come out there. I mean, I knew him. Yeah. We used to drive around in his golf cart in Hyannis. We'd watch his helicopter land. We'd do all that. But my Uncle Bobby was really important to
me.
I was 13 years old. Yeah. He was my mother's favorite brother. Oh. They were like unbelievably close. Obliterated my mother. She was done. And then those guys asked me the next 2 months later, and I said yes. I didn't know I was saying yes because of the anger and the fear and the terror inside of me.
Yeah.
I just thought I was just saying yes.
Yeah.
And as soon as I did, that worked. It worked. These things work for
folks. Of course. That's why people do them.
They work.
That's right. They feel not just better. They feel great.
Yeah. And Nora talks about, God bless Nora Vogt, she talks about the reward center of the brain and the power of these things in that. Because that people need to understand out there in society, in terms of my advocacy, that these aren't people that are just doing this just because they want to.
Or they have a moral weakness.
Yeah, they have a moral weakness, or they're just like, lazy or whatever it is.
You know,
right.
And by the way, it's not – it's people, I think, normies think in terms of getting high. It's about feeling better.
Yeah, it's about feeling better. Yeah. and easing the pain.
Yeah.
I mean, and there's a lot of pain out there.
People don't get that. Let's talk to Andrea. What's up, Andrea?
Hi, guys. So my question is about, I had early adolescent trauma. I had addiction in my family. And I became a food addict.
What was the trauma?
No. When I was 15 and Catholic, a married 29-year-old decided that I loved him and he loved me, and a sexual relationship was a good idea.
Oh boy, oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. So I lost about 100 pounds about 2 years ago, and I got to a point where I realized I was scared out of my mind. Because if I lose this weight, then, you know, people will, you know, whatever.
And well,
how do I do it? Hang on.
You will lose that protective barrier you had around you. And
exactly.
Even worse, men might become attracted to you again, and you'd have to relive that trauma. So you really got to get into some heavy therapy, Andres, with someone who has a deep sensitivity to this.
Now, I'm in cognitive therapy, and you had somebody on a couple months ago about behavioral therapy. No,
emotionally focused
therapy. Emotional therapy.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of emotional. Let me modify it a little bit for you and say someone who really understands trauma. You need somebody who has your kind of behavioral therapies help change behavior. They have good. They look good on research papers and stuff. Right. And because the outcomes are good, but in terms of real recovery, really getting better, I'm not so sure. Again, I'm no position to really even say that, but I just see real serious change happening in more emotionally based therapies. This is more Alan Shore's domain.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's where he's talking about really reforming attachments so you can tolerate being close to people again. And, you know, that right brain communication, people don't think about that.
No.
And so, Andrea, go maybe listen to that lecture again. And I mean, that podcast again. What number was that with Sue Johnson? Do you know Gary offhand? He's looking it up. There's a whole sort of
15,
number 15, a whole field of therapy opening up that's built on all the stuff of Alan Shore. Yeah, and really, it's what recovery has been doing forever.
Right.
Let's talk to Avery. Avery, what's going on?
Hey, Andrew. How are you?
Good.
Well, I had a question. I've been sober for about 2 years. I'm 27. And there's a group of people in my 12-step program that are smoking pot. And they seem to be carrying on a 12-step program.
If they were in California, they'd have a prescription and a doctor would be advising them to keep smoking the pot. But they'll have Chris address this. Go ahead.
Exactly. I just wonder if your experience, can you sustain that long term?
Chris, you answer that.
Well, you know, it all depends on the kind of recovery you want. I mean, I got sober in 12-step programs, and there was we're basically we don't do anything from the neck up, and that includes everything. So I adhere to that. I know there are a lot of people who medicate. Some folks need medication, and others.
But any medication. Benzodiazepine, opioids, pot, alcohol, put alcohol in that medication category too, that activate the reward system that is disordered in addiction is going to reawaken this biology. Even if everything else is perfect, it's going to happen again. It's just, you're just biding your time till it explodes.
I feel like, of course, I'm an alcoholic. Like, I'm going to be curious. I'm like, ooh, I want to try that. But is it worth the risk?
No, Avery, please don't do that. That's a terrible idea. Terrible idea.
Yeah,
let everyone else manage their own recoveries. You sound like you really have a good recovery going on. Don't mess it up.
I do, and I love my home group, and things are wonderful, I don't know why I'm thinking about it.
Well, you should look at that. That's what you should look at. Is there something interpersonally going on in your relationship, husband, some stress you're out?
I don't know. I'm in a relationship with someone who's in recovery, and it's just tough.
Something's not right. Something's not right. I can feel it. Something's wrong in your something's wrong in your relationship, and it's affecting your recovery. I can just feel it.
It absolutely is, and I know that. Like, that's why that even sounds, because 6 months ago when I was not dating, that wouldn't have sounded even appealing to me.
Nothing takes addicts out more often than relationships. It just takes
relationships
them down.
And money.
Money and really, but relationships, I see all the time. So particularly when you're vulnerable, like right now, do not go to a doctor and say, I'm anxious, I can't sleep, I have pain. What right. do not do that right. because you
I'm
will...
doing the fourth step in 3 days. Not that.
Oh, you also got to get to your fourth step.
Yeah,
yeah, for sure. But don't go to doctors.
Thank you.
Okay,
good
all
for
right.
you.
Good got luck, Avery. You
I
get
appreciate
some
it.
Right.
Day at a time.
Yeah, you see how that works. That even when
That's
they're
amazing.
Right, you start thinking your disease starts
right.
come surfacing yeah. again when things are not working right.
That's right.
And as opposed to her really looking honestly at her relationship, which is where the stress and the problems and the whatever evocative stuff was going on, she could have done that with her sponsor, but her disease goes, don't look at that.
Right.
Those guys smoking pot over there, they're on to something. They are on to something.
Oh, we are. Yeah, we are devious.
But it's funny.
Yeah, no, it
right?
is funny.
It's
yeah,
awesome. It's the richest, right. most incredible right. group of human beings,
right.
and it's such a window into what is rich about human beings.
Yeah, yeah, it's fantastic.
All right, my friend, we got to wrap this up. Really, really a treat for me. I want to shake your hand and say
so
thank
much.
You. Really a
no,
treat.
Thank
and,
you. For
and it's interesting
everything.
To me. I can see when I talked to you when you're writing your book, you were probably about halfway in.
Right.
I can see the totality of what you've got now, you know, in the book. So I think it's affected you. I think the book will affect other people if
I
they sit
so.
And read it.
Yeah.
Recover to Live is the book, available at Amazon. By the way, you can follow us at Dr. Drew Podcast on Twitter for call-in times and for the topics we are doing on that day. ChristopherKennedyLawford.com is the website. His Twitter is at Chris Lawford, and I'll see you next time.
This is Corolla Digital.